From how many crimes, wars, and murders, from how many horrors and misfortunes, might not anyone have saved mankind by pulling up the stakes or filling up the ditch and crying to his fellows, "Beware of listening to this impostor. You are undone if you once forget that the fruits of the earth belong to us all, and the earth itself to nobody." All subsequent advances have been apparently so many steps towards the perfection of the individual, Rousseau wrote, but in reality, so many steps towards the decrepitude of the species. Rousseau brilliantly identifies that private property and the division of labor are among the chief drivers of civilizational and economic advance. He just hates them. He writes, "In a word, so long as men undertook only what a single person could accomplish and confined themselves to such arts as did not require the joint labor of several hands, they lived free, healthy, honest, and happy lives. So long as their nature allowed, and as they continue to enjoy the pleasures of mutual, independent intercourse. But from the moment one man began to stand in need of help of another, from the moment it appeared advantageous to any one man to have enough provisions for two, equality disappeared. Property was introduced, work became indispensable, and vast forests became smiling fields, which man had to water with the sweat of his brow, and where slavery and misery were soon seen to germinate and grow up with the crops. Metallurgy and agriculture were the two arts which produced this great revolution. The poets tell us it was gold and silver, but for the philosophers, it was iron and corn which first civilized men and ruined humanity." I'm quite hard on Rousseau here, but I must confess that I've grown to have a greater appreciation of his writings. His personal behavior was repugnant. His inconsistencies and conclusions are often infuriating. But his eye for the false pieties, hypocrisies, and corruptions of others was as remarkable as his skill at describing them. Long before neuroscience confirmed it, Rousseau recognized that we all crave social recognition as special, unique, or important. Rousseau called this amour propre, or self-love, which is often translated into English as vanity or pride or esteem. He contrasts it with amour de soi, which annoyingly also means self-love. Amour de soi, according to Rousseau, is the natural self-interestedness primitive man shared with the animals before he was corrupted by society. Amour de soi is always noble and good because in Rousseau's state of nature, man's self-interest never came at the expense of another. This is, of course, nonsense. Animals, particularly predators, pursue their self-interest in ways that harm others, and primitive humans are certainly no exception. Rousseau even recognized that amour propre has its roots in sexual competition and status-seeking in small tribes or bands. Rousseau believed that the social ills of modernity stemmed from an inflammation of amour propre, in part because the market system enthrones wealth as the measure of social status. In other words, by Rousseau's own often brilliant analysis, ideology is secondary to what he calls passions. And he's right. As the author of the first modern autobiography, Rousseau was honest about his quest to find his real self and stay true to it. He was more dishonest about his contempt for the concerns of polite society. He loved its attention. He may have believed that the desire for status and the respect of others, amour propre, was the source of so much evil in the world, but he craved status and recognition himself. There was a Trumpian quality to Rousseau in that he seemed to believe it was better to be talked about negatively than not at all. Near the end of his discourse on the moral effects of the arts and sciences, Rousseau makes a prediction. Mankind will one day recognize the horrible mistake he has made and offer up a prayer to the Lord. "Almighty God, Thou who holdest in thy hand the minds of men, deliver us from the fatal arts and sciences of our forefathers. Give us back ignorance, innocence, and poverty, which alone can make us happy and are precious in thy sight. You can't get less Lockean than that. Rousseau is called the father of Romanticism for a reason. The Romantic eye sees the modern world as alien and alienating, amputating the soul and at war with nature. The system is rigged, as so many people say today, is, in its most intense forms, a Romantic battle cry. Indeed, radicalism in all its forms is fundamentally Romantic, whether it comes from the right or the left. The ambition to tear it all down should be seen first as a psychological response to the status quo. Different ideologies color that ambition in different ways. But the substance beneath is not ideological, but instinctual. Lenin, Hitler, and all of their petty imitators begin with the assumption that the current edifice of civilization is corrupt and must be torn down. Radicalism is Romanticism taken to its extreme. Get rid of it all. Start over. Another way to look at Rousseau, however, is that he was the father of the modern idea of alienation. People no doubt felt alienated prior to the Enlightenment. But, like so many other passions and ideas, such feelings were seen through the prism of religion. One solved feelings of alienation, never mind undeserved status, by getting right with God. But the Enlightenment had dethroned God and made man the measure of man. And it was Rousseau who first argued for getting right with yourself, because you, your conscience, your inner lantern of truth, lit the path in this world. He believed there was, or had been, an authentic, real noble savage deep down inside every one of us, and that civilization had corrupted it by making us care more about status, wealth, respect, fame, and other artificial concerns. In pre-Enlightenment society, according to Rousseau, the church was a kind of corrupt guild, using its power for its own benefit and not for the needs of the faithful or the citizens in general. He said the new princes of the Enlightenment were no better than the princes and priests they had dethroned. The same ambitious intellectuals casting themselves as free thinkers and philosophers, Rousseau wrote, would have been for the very same reason nothing more than a fanatic of the church in an earlier era. Rousseau was prescient about the role intellectuals would play in modern societies and how ideologues, not just intellectuals, but also artists, educators, and every other profession that works with ideas and concepts, have replaced priests as the definers of meaning. For Rousseau, the so-called Age of Reason was simply a new age of oppression by another name. The Enlightenment theories of democracy and limited government, as developed by Locke, Montesquieu, and the founders, were to him no better than what they sought to replace. Here, we can see why I think Rousseau's personal character informs his philosophy. The Scottish writer James Boswell recounted a conversation he had with Rousseau. "Sir, I have no liking for the world," Rousseau told him. "I live here in a world of fantasies, and I cannot tolerate the world as it is. Mankind disgusts me. And my housekeeper tells me that I am in far better humors on a day when I am alone than on those I have been in company." This dual indictment of the Enlightenment and the old system of absolutism might sound a bit like anarchism or libertarianism. The system is rigged, the rulers are in it for themselves, don't trust the man. But Rousseau's solution wasn't to reject status coercion and manipulation. It was to employ them for ostensibly purer ends. For Rousseau, man and society alike were disordered, unnatural, broken, alienated. Individuals were out of harmony with their nature, and that meant society was too. The only way to fix people was to create a new society empowered to fill the holes in our souls. Salvation was a collective endeavor. Mankind could not go back to being a solitary noble savage. Mankind must find new meaning in the group, governed by the general will, a kind of collective consciousness that outranked the individual conscience. This was a brilliant intellectual updating of the tribal instinct. Every citizen in Rousseau's ideal society would have meaning through the group and only through the group. The group itself would be the object of a new religious faith that defined one's purpose in relation to service to the whole. Tellingly, Rousseau looked to the militarized state of Sparta for a new model of social organization in which social planners would apply the ancient Roman and Greek concept of a civil religion to modern society. This civil religion would emotionally bind the citizens to the general will and the community. Rousseau's civil religion is a thoroughly totalitarian affair. If you refuse to subscribe to the dogmas of the new civil religion, you should be banished. He who publicly accepts the law of the general will and then violates it, let him be punished with death. He has committed the worst of all crimes, that of lying before the law. Rousseau continues, "Those who distinguish civil from theological intolerance are to my mind mistaken. The two forms are inseparable. It is impossible to live at peace with those we regard as damned. To love them would be to hate God, who punishes them. We positively must either claim or torment them. To this end, public censors and other magistrates would mold and define public opinion and identify unbelievers in need of extermination. The state, in other words, had complete authority to improve men's souls for the greater good. Thus, Rousseau sought to eliminate the original division of labor that Christianity had introduced into the West through St. Augustine. He wanted a new theocracy that closed the space between the religious and the secular. This idea amounts to what the great sociologist Robert Nisbet called, with perhaps only modest exaggeration, the most powerful state to be found anywhere in political philosophy. Nationalism served as the framework for this new imagined community. The most obvious illustration of Rousseau's ideas at work can be found in the horrors of the Reign of Terror at the end of the French Revolution, in which the Committee of Public Safety became a real-world example of Rousseau's boards of censors, sentencing unbelievers to death in the name of the great new French nation they were building. The revolutionaries believed they were creating a nation from scratch in year zero. Rousseau's social contract was hailed as the beacon of legislators. Maximilien Robespierre, the chief architect of the Jacobin Reign of Terror, and thus the first modern totalitarian mass murderer, reportedly read Rousseau every day like a daily devotional. Robespierre used Rousseau's ideas to justify his authority in a higher ideal. "For us, we are not of any party. We serve no faction. You know it, brothers and friends. Our will is the general will," he proclaimed in a 1792 address to leaders of the various French departments. Even after the Thermidorian reaction, when Robespierre was killed in a coup by a faction appalled by his excesses, the French revolutionaries did not abandon Rousseau. They believed that Robespierre had betrayed the true spirit of Rousseau. In 1794, the revolutionary government called for Rousseau's remains to be exhumed and brought to Paris to be reinterred at the Pantheon. A copy of the social contract was carried on a velvet cushion while a 12-horse carriage pulled a statue of Rousseau. The stories Rousseau and Locke told, as well as the stories we tell of Rousseau and Locke, represent the two main currents in Western civilization and increasingly in modernity itself. It is a fight between the idea that our escape from the past has been a glorious improvement over mankind's natural state and the idea that the world we have created is corrupting because it is artificial. One side says that external moral codes and representative government are a liberating blessing. The other says that the truth is found not outside of ourselves in the form of universal rules and tolerance for others, but in our own feelings and the meaning we get from belonging to a group. Locke and Rousseau may stand as useful markers between the left and the right, but the divide is more fundamental than that, for it runs straight through the human heart. There are people of the left who are more Lockean than they realize, and there are people of the right who are far more Rousseauian than they would care to admit. Locke represents the idea that we can conquer not just nature, but human nature. Rousseau is a stand-in for the notion that such conquest is oppressive. This tension is not permanently resolvable, because the Lockean world is an imposition on human nature, and human nature doesn't change. Each of us starts our journey as an ignoble savage. Nobility must be taught and earned. It is not inherited. 6. The American Miracle. They put it in writing. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thomas Jefferson et al., The Declaration of Independence. The Founding Fathers were wrong. It is not self-evident that man is endowed by his Creator with certain unalienable rights. Colloquially, self-evident simply means obvious. Something that is self-evident, according to the dictionary, is something that does not require demonstration. The existence of gravity is self-evident, and that is a very easy thing to prove. It is obvious that fire burns, and if you need a demonstration, I can provide one on request. Meanwhile, how does one demonstrate that we are endowed by our Creator with unalienable rights? People have been trying to demonstrate that our Creator exists for thousands of years. If that cannot be done to everyone's satisfaction, it seems a daunting task to prove He created unalienable rights. The simple fact is that the existence of natural rights, like the existence of God Himself, requires a leap of faith. Meanwhile, the vast history of mankind provides one endlessly dreary demonstration after another that people can be alienated from their rights quite easily, starting with their right to life. The first and most glorious achievement of the American founding was to assert, in writing, not argue for, claim, or suggest, that all men are created equal and endowed by our Creator with unalienable rights. It's a bit of a strained analogy, but in the context of the miracle, one can think of the English people as the Jews. The Jews introduced a moral, monotheistic framework into the world. But in ancient times, it only applied to Jews. Christianity took those precepts and universalized them. Similarly, the English introduced an understanding of rights and liberty into the world and made it work. But initially, it only applied to the English. America universalized these English ideas. It is a common response to such claims to point out that the founders didn't mean it. They were hypocrites who denied the rights of slaves, women, and to a lesser but still significant extent, the propertyless. But this is an exercise in looking through the wrong end of the telescope, which robs the heroism of every soul who made the world a better place. We judge the strides we make in the present by the extent of our improvement over the past, but we have an annoying tendency to judge the past by the standards of the present. The study of the past with one eye, so to speak, upon the present is the source of all sins and sophistries in history, starting with the simplest of them, the anachronism. It is the fallacy into which we slip when we are giving the judgments that seem most assuredly self-evident, Herbert Butterfield observed. And it is the essence of what we mean by the word unhistorical. The founders advanced the wheel of history as none had before. They started a revolutionary new chapter in the story of humanity by broadening the principles laid out by Locke and the English people generally. Consider the evolution of the Declaration of Independence. Some 90 years before Jefferson put pen to paper, the Glorious Revolution had cemented the English commitment to ancient English rights. That revolution had a huge impact on the politics and popular attitudes in the American colonies. Just as the threat of absolutism in the mother country had been thwarted, it was curtailed in the New World as well, allowing for representative institutions to develop organically. That English notions of rights and liberties would intensify only makes sense given that the yoke of the crown felt tighter, or at least more unjust, across the Atlantic. As the case for independence grew in the hearts and minds of the colonists, the argument inevitably shifted from the rights and liberties of Englishmen to the rights and liberties of men generally. Events, in other words, forced the Americans to shed allegiance not only to the English crown, but also to the idea of English particularism. A good illustration of this evolutionary process is the expression, "a man's home is his castle." The original saying was, "an Englishman's home is his castle," and it was more than just a slogan for husbands trying to get out of doing chores. The idea that even the king himself could not enter a man's home without an invitation is precisely one of those ancient English rights and liberties. It was a common understanding centuries before the Glorious Revolution. Sir Edward Coke wrote the cultural custom into the common law in 1628. "For a man's house is his castle, et doma sua quic est tutissimum refugium," and each man's home is his safest refuge. In 1763, William Pitt clarified the meaning of castle. "The poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England cannot enter." Now, in practice, this did not mean that the home was an inviolable sanctuary in which one could break the law or escape from its reach. What it meant was that the state needed a good reason to enter a home, and the state needed to make its case to a judge who would issue a writ or later a warrant. This, in short, is where the Fourth Amendment right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures comes from. What began as an English custom, over time, became an inalienable right. The Declaration of Independence follows a similar pattern. It is chock-a-block with echoes of Locke, from the life, liberty, and happiness line, to the talk of unalienable rights. But the Declaration is less indebted to Locke than it is to the American people, who at the time had only recently stopped thinking of themselves as Englishmen. Years later, Jefferson would write that, "neither aiming at originality, or principles, or sentiments, nor yet copied from any particular and previous writing, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind." Proof of this can be found in the fact that the Declaration was not quite as original a document as we've come to be taught. Pauline Mayer found that there were in fact some 90 Declarations of Independence written up by various groups, from county conventions to New York mechanics guilds and Massachusetts town halls. Jefferson wasn't inventing anything in the Declaration. Rather, a brilliant writer on deadline, he contented himself with eloquently summarizing what was little more than American conventional wisdom. As Gordon S. Wood has observed, when the Declaration was issued, the important part was the conclusion, the break with England. Only later did the beginning, "all men are created equal," take on philosophical and metaphysical significance. "Certainly no one initially saw the Declaration as a classic statement of political principles," Wood writes. Only in the 1790s, with the emergence of the bitter partisan politics between the Federalists and the Jefferson-led Republicans, did the Declaration begin to be celebrated as a great founding document. And that celebration evolved into sacredness. Let us revere the Declaration of Independence, Abraham Lincoln insisted. Let us readopt the Declaration of Independence, and with it, the practices and policy which harmonize with it. That is what he did in the Gettysburg Address when he proclaimed, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Lincoln essentially rewrote the meaning of the founding and consecrated it with the blood of Americans. It didn't matter that Southerners had a plausible argument that they understood the Declaration better. What mattered was the new meaning breathed into it. The founders may well have believed in the Lockean notion of natural rights, but it is not news that they didn't apply it consistently. They risked their lives and sacred honor for more worldly reasons. But Lincoln sifted a golden idea from the currents of our story and molded it into an icon. That idea of human equality took deeper root in American life because of it. A century later, Martin Luther King Jr. did the same thing once again. In 1963, in his I Have a Dream speech, he said, "In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Both Lincoln and King were appealing to the story, the best story we tell about ourselves. That our story begins with Americans falling short of the ideals embedded in the founding is not an indictment of the ideals. It is a testament to the nobility of America's story arc. Without even considering the material prosperity that the American miracle created, not just for its own citizens, but for billions of people around the world, if America had done nothing else but this, it would be a glorious leap forward for humanity. Let us now look more closely at how the story begins. It is something of an article of faith, particularly among some American conservatives, that the Founding Fathers were deeply influenced by John Locke. For generations, this was the consensus opinion of most leading historians as well. Some recent scholarship is more skeptical. The skeptics have a much better argument than I thought when I set out to write this book. For instance, I searched the National Archives' wonderful online database of writings from the founding, thinking it would be a simple task to find one encomium after another to the man often described as the father of the English Enlightenment, the philosopher of freedom, and the founder of liberalism. There are some, to be sure, but far fewer than you might think. Perhaps most shocking, there are no references to Locke in the Federalist Papers, though he does have a brief cameo in the Anti-Federalist Papers. Oscar and Lillian Hanlon note that even though Locke dedicated an entire chapter to slavery, there's no record of any founder invoking his work in the many debates about the subject during the period. One of the few unequivocal accolades from a signatory of the Declaration of Independence comes from James Wilson, a prominent drafter of the Constitution and one of the first six Supreme Court justices. At the ratifying convention, Wilson said, "The truth is that the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority remains with the people. The practical recognition of this truth was reserved for the honor of this country. I recollect no constitution founded on this principle, but we have witnessed the improvement and enjoy the happiness of seeing it carried into practice. The great and penetrating mind of Locke seems to be the only one that pointed towards even the theory of this great truth." We do know that Thomas Jefferson was a great admirer of Locke. Indeed, in a letter to Benjamin Rush, Jefferson tells a story of Hamilton's visit to his home. On Jefferson's wall hung portraits of John Locke, Isaac Newton, and Francis Bacon. Hamilton asked who they were. Jefferson replied that they were his trinity of the greatest men who ever lived. Still, there's not much evidence in his papers that he read Locke's two treatises. Nor was there a copy in the book collection that he bequeathed to the Library of Congress. On the other hand, Jefferson took copious notes from Locke's Letter Concerning Toleration, which served as the inspiration for his own Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. The statute is another good example of how ideas drive a story on the ground and how the unfolding story refines those ideas to the point of creating new ones. Locke had argued that Catholics and atheists could not be loyal subjects or citizens. All those who enter into the Catholic faith do thereby ipso facto deliver themselves up to the protection and service of another prince. Atheists cannot be trusted because promises, covenants, and oaths, which are the bonds of human society, can have no hold upon an atheist. Jefferson, meanwhile, took the internal logic of Locke and extended it to its final conclusion. The statute begins, "An act for establishing religious freedom. Whereas Almighty God hath created the mind free, that all attempts to influence it by temporal punishments or burdens or by civil incapacitations tend only to beget habits of hypocrisy and meanness, and are a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion, who being Lord both of body and mind, yet chose not to propagate it by coercions on either, as was in his almighty power to do." The statute not only disestablished the Church of England as the official faith of Virginia, but also guaranteed religious liberty for Protestants, Catholics, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, and even pagans. This is just one facet of the transformation wrought less by Locke himself than by what I call the Lockean Revolution. The intellectual historians who want to play connect the dots miss the broader revolution in rhetoric that transformed the world. As the Enlightenment unfolded across the landscape of Europe and America, Locke's name became a kind of shorthand for liberty and natural rights, even among people who never read or fully understood him. What's indisputable is that Locke was routinely invoked in sermons by pro-revolution pastors, which were often turned into pamphlets. Sermons were at least 10% of all the pamphlets published at the time. So great was Locke's influence among pastors, and so great was the influence of the pastors with the people, that the historian Clinton Rossiter concluded, "Had ministers been the only spokesmen of the American cause, had Jefferson, Adams, and Otis never appeared in print, the political thought of the revolution would have followed almost exactly the same line, with perhaps a little more mention of God, but certainly no less of John Locke." As counterintuitive as it might seem, the founder's intellectual debt to Locke may have had more to do with his philosophical, then considered scientific, writings on empiricism than with his political work in the Second Treatise. In 1760, John Adams remarked of Locke's epistemological writings that he steered his course into the unenlightened regions of the human mind and, like Columbus, had discovered a new world. As discussed earlier, Locke's argument for the blank slate helped to undermine the case for hereditary power by arguing that all men were born equally free with the same natural rights. The American founders carried the Lockean argument even further, though not far enough. They declared unremitting war on hereditary aristocracy in all its unnatural or unjust forms. Hereditary slavery excepted, unfortunately. Just as Locke and the Glorious Revolution overturned the divine right of kings, the founders, particularly Thomas Jefferson, took dead aim at the divine rights of nobles and aristocrats. If all men are created equal, and if government is established by the people, not by God, then the government cannot recognize rankings of men. As Thomas Paine put it, Virtue is not hereditary. The founders understood all too well that mediocre men were capable of being born to high stations, and exceptional men were often born to low ones. But even then, just because some men prove themselves to be superior to other men, that does not mean they have any special privileges or authority under the law. As Thomas Jefferson explained, just because Sir Isaac Newton was superior to others in understanding, he was not therefore lord of the person or property of others. A man entering a courtroom in the newly formed United States of America may have had some piece of paper saying he was a baron or a duke, and he'd be free to brag about it at the local tavern. But the judge would give that no weight in his dispute with a bricklayer. The project was more Lockean than anything Locke imagined could happen in England. Strictly speaking, aristocracy doesn't mean rule of the nobility. It means rule of the best, which is how the Greeks first conceived of the term. It was only later, when the corrupting influence of human nature worked its will, and aristocrats tried to lock in their power for posterity, that this notion became infused with notions of hereditary status. What the founders wanted was a return to the original Greek conception, which Jefferson called a natural aristocracy. He wanted to rake from the rubbish annually in search of the best geniuses. Public education, the founder of the University of Virginia argued, elevates those persons whom nature hath endowed with genius and virtue, should be rendered by liberal education worthy to receive and able to guard the sacred deposit of the rights of their fellow citizens, and should be called to that charge without regard to wealth, birth, or other accidental conditions or circumstance. This is what the liberal in liberal arts is supposed to mean. After the Revolution, Jefferson fought to rid America of entail, the system of irrevocable trusts that barred the sale or division of landholdings, and primogeniture, which required all property to be left to the oldest son. These tended to concentrate landed estates, elevating some families and their offspring beyond their merit. Jefferson considered his successful effort to abolish entail and primogeniture to be among his greatest accomplishments as a legislator. He saw these efforts as essential to eradicating every fiber of ancient or future aristocracy and to lay a foundation for a government truly republican. Identity politics will be a recurring theme in the pages that follow. But for now, it's worth making this simple observation. Notions of inherited nobility are an ancient form of identity politics. Identitarianism holds that a person has special status based upon criteria not of his or her own making. The founders didn't follow through on this logic when it came to slavery, though many wanted to, but they lit the fuse on the bomb that would demolish such thinking, at least for a time. It's difficult to appreciate how radical a departure all of this was from the way the world had worked until that moment. George Washington could have been a king. He declined. He even had to be persuaded to be president. When King George III asked his American portraitist, Benjamin West, what Washington would do after winning independence, West replied, "They say he will return to his farm." "If he does that," the gobsmacked king replied, "Washington will be the greatest man in the world." But even though the founders were creating something new in the world, they did not believe that they could repeal the laws of human nature. The founders knew that one could not eliminate the natural human tendency to form factions, including aristocracies of wealth, status, and power. But the system of government they established, they hoped, would make it impossible for any faction to attain lasting concentrated power. The structure of the federal government itself was designed to divide power in all the ways we learned in civics class. Checks and balances, divided government, separation of powers. In one of the most famous passages in the Federalist Papers, James Madison writes, But the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. The provision for defense must in this, as in all other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of attack. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government, which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control on the government. But experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. This was a great advance on Locke, who never gave a persuasive and cogent explanation for why majority rule could not be tyrannical. Meanwhile, the founders understood that the majority could be a threat to liberty too. Obviously, they couldn't see Napoleon coming, but they understood the threat of Bonapartism entirely. Close students of history, they appreciated how a conquering general like a Caesar or Cromwell, two names that appear often in the Federalist Papers, with the masses on his side, could take over the Republican government. Brutus, one of the anonymous writers in the Anti-Federalist Papers, put it this way. In the first, the liberties of the Commonwealth were destroyed and the Constitution overturned by an army led by Julius Caesar, who was appointed to the command by the constitutional authority of that Commonwealth. He changed it from a free republic whose fame is still celebrated by all the world into that of the most absolute despotism. The Constitution, particularly the Bill of Rights, took certain vexatious political questions and made them off-limits, at least in theory, from the politicians. Free speech, freedom of worship, freedom of assembly, the right to bear arms, the right to property, including intellectual property, these are all massive bulwarks against despotic power. Even the phrasing of the key amendments is essential. Congress shall make no law abridging this right or that. In other words, the restrictions are all on the power of the state. The rights of the people, collectively and individually, are upstream of the powers of the government. This, in short, is the difference between Lockeanism and Rousseauism. For Locke, the individual is prior to the state. For Rousseau, the state, or the general will, is prior to the people. For the Lockeans, our rights come from God, not from government. For the disciples of Rousseau, our rights are indistinguishable, or at least inseparable, from our duties to the state. Perhaps the Constitution's most important contribution is its most prosaic quality. It's written down and very hard to change. Being written down for all to read gives ownership to everyone and creates what economists call path dependence for how political disputes are resolved. It reminds us that our fundamental laws are outside the authority of men. It creates the space necessary for institutional pluralism to flourish. The fact that the Constitution is hard to change, a great frustration to passionate political movements of every stripe, automatically confers deep democratic legitimacy to any successful alterations, and provides assurance that we will not sacrifice some fundamental liberty in the heat of a given moment. We may, in such moments, ignore the Constitution, but it sits there, outside the time and space of any political moment, as a national conscience, reminding us that such transgressions must be rectified. There's a decidedly deist flavor to the American founding. Deism holds that God, or the Creator, is like a watchmaker who makes his creation, winds it up, and then interferes no more. Some of the founders were indeed deists, and many more were influenced by deism. And in a sense, they did set up the machinery of liberty and then got out of the way. But I think there's a better way to understand the founders' vision and how it differed from other Enlightenment projects, specifically those of revolutionary France. America borrowed a great deal from French thought, but we cherry-picked the best bits without subscribing to their entire worldview. The philosophes and revolutionaries of Paris were far more ambitious than their counterparts in America. Partially thanks to the influence of Rousseau, they wanted to create, guide, and direct a whole new path for humanity. For all their hatred of religion, they nonetheless set out to create a new religion, a whole system of meaning for the French people. Taking after Rousseau, the French believed in the perfectibility of man. The scientific revolution had granted the new intellectuals the power to create perfect societies and perfect men. As Nicolas de Condorcet put it, there is a science that can foresee the progress of humankind, direct it, and accelerate it. The Americans rejected the perfectibility of man, believing the best government could do was take man's nature into account and channel it towards productive ends. Yuval Levin argues that you can see the differences in these two worldviews in the metaphors the two camps used in explaining what the state should do. The French strain emphasizes movement. The state is there to deliver the people somewhere, advance the wheel of history, etc. In the English version, the state is there to create a zone of liberty for people to choose their own direction. One of my favorite illustrations of how this is as much a cultural disagreement as a philosophical one can be found in the differences between French and English gardens. For instance, the French gardens at Versailles, with their ornate, geometric, nature-defying designs, illustrate how the gardener imposes his vision on nature. Nature is brought to heel by reason. The classic English garden, on the other hand, was intended to let nature take its course, to let each bush, tree, and vegetable achieve its own ideal nature. The role of the English gardener was to protect his garden by weeding it, maintaining fences, and being ever watchful for predators and poachers. The American founders were gardeners, not engineers. The government of the founders' constitution is more than merely a night watchman state, but not very much more. It creates the rules of the garden and the gardeners and little more. This does not mean the government cannot intervene in the society or the economy. It means that when it does so, it should be to protect liberty, which Madison defined in Federalist No. 10 as the first object of government. As the quintessential Scottish Enlightenment thinker Adam Smith wrote in 1755, "Little else is requisite to carry a state to the highest degree of opulence from the lowest barbarism, but peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice, all the rest being brought by the natural course of things. All governments which thwart this natural course, which force things into another channel, or which endeavor to arrest the progress of society at a particular point, are unnatural, and to support themselves are obliged to be oppressive and tyrannical." I think the garden metaphor works better than the watchmaker image because so many of the founders were active participants in the unfolding American experiment, as George Washington called it. From Shays' Rebellion to the First Bank of the United States, the Louisiana Purchase, and the War of 1812, the founders were attentive gardeners in this new nation, creating the conditions for prosperity, fending off predators, and even expanding the garden itself. We should turn now from the founders to the inhabitants of the garden itself. For the architects of the Constitution were ultimately their servants, both reflecting and guided by their spirit. Although the American colonists were culturally indebted to Britain, by the time of the Revolution, a new, distinct American character and culture began to manifest itself. One reason the founding generation could sift the gold from the dross of the English tradition was that they were alienated from it, literally and figuratively. Living thousands of miles across an ocean from their ancestral home, many of the cultural assumptions that seemed live and immediate when living in London or Manchester felt dead or distant in Boston or New York. Just as Texans don't immediately look to Washington to solve their problems, the idea of looking across the Atlantic seemed increasingly irrational and cumbersome. This alienation from the mother country had an added psychological component. As discussed, British primogeniture laws required that the firstborn son of an aristocratic family get everything, the title, the land, etc. But what about the other kids? They were required to make their way in the world. To be sure, they had advantages, educational, financial, and social, over the children of the lower classes. But they still needed to pursue a career. The grander families of Virginia, including the Washingtons, were known as the second sons, writes Daniel Hannan. Many of the younger brothers who had founded their lines in the New World had borne with them a sense of injustice that they had been denied any share of their ancestral lands through an accident of timing, Hannan adds. This idea that primogeniture was a violation of natural justice was expressed by Edmund in King Lear. Thou, nature, art my goddess. To thy law my services are bound. Wherefore should I stand in the plague of custom and permit, the curiosity of nations to deprive me, for that I am 12 or 14 moonshines, lag of a brother? In fact, Hannan and Matt Ridley suggest that much of the prosperity and expansion of the British Empire in the 18th century can be ascribed to an intriguing historical accident. At the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the children of the affluent nobility had a much lower mortality rate for all the obvious reasons. They had more access to medicine, rudimentary as it was, but also better nutrition and vastly superior living and working conditions than the general population. As a result, the nobility were dramatically more fecund than the lower classes. Consequently, a large cohort of educated and ambitious young men who were not first born were set free to make their way in the world. If you have 5 boys, only one gets to be the duke. The rest must become officers, priests, doctors, lawyers, academics, and businessmen. This is not an abstract point, but a vital cultural and sociological one. European and English societies were drenched in notions of class. The English who valued that system often returned home to England or moved to Canada. The Americans who stayed kept the English attachment to natural rights and popular sovereignty, but they also rejected the cultural obsession with rank and status and had a powerful attachment to liberty. Seymour Martin Lipset, the great political sociologist and probably the greatest student of American exceptionalism since James Bryce or de Tocqueville, had a wonderful observation about America. I heard him share it many times. At the time of the founding, if you were a loyalist or royalist with no interest in severing ties with the British crown, you often moved to or stayed in Canada. If you believed in the principles of the founding, you either stayed in America or moved there. This was one of the greatest natural experiments in political history. These were 2 populations with the same basic ethnic makeup, the same religious beliefs, and for the most part, the same language. And yet, these 2 nations produced 2 very different political cultures. Lipset loved to point out that 2 centuries later, both the U.S. government and the Canadian government mandated that all of their citizens switch to the metric system. The Canadians, with their deeply ingrained deference to political authority, obliged almost instantly. Drive around Canada, he'd chuckle, and everything is in kilometers. Not so in America. The U.S. government asked, but the answer was no. This points to the revolution in culture the American founding represents. I think Gordon Wood is surely right that the significance of the Declaration of Independence at the time lay largely in the conclusion, independence, rather than the introduction. But that does not mean the American Revolution was seen as just another conflict between empire and colony, or that America's founding did not represent an earthquake in Western thinking even at the time. Europe's monarchs and emperors recognized the American War for Independence was not just another grubby revolt, though they often said it was for propaganda purposes. The rulers feared that their subjects would see the American action not as a rebellion against the rightful monarch in his own territories, there had been plenty of rebellions against European sovereigns, but as the proclamation of a revolutionary doctrine of universal application, as the Declaration indeed announced it to be, wrote the late great journalist Henry Fairley. Any notion that the War of Independence was only a rebellion falls to the ground. Both rulers and their subjects saw it as a revolution of universal appeal. And the revolution was not merely political. It also had economic motivations and consequences. What the rebellious Americans wanted, writes economic historian Robert E. Wright, and with ratification of the Constitution obtained, was what today we call economic freedom. In other words, they wanted to engage in entrepreneurial activities subject only to necessary regulations and taxes and credible assurances that they could keep whatever wealth those activities generated. This is why, for the young Americans, economic and political liberty were indivisible. This was a radical expansion of even the British understanding of liberty, which in practice always tended to take the economic rights of nobles more seriously. Meanwhile, the rulers of Europe were aghast at the idea that merchants and strivers should undermine their sovereignty, which is why King George III lamented that his rule was being threatened by a bunch of grocers. Even Karl Marx declared that the American War of Independence sounded the tocsin for the European middle class. The public here is extremely occupied with the rebels in America, the Danish Foreign Minister A.P. Bernstorff wrote to a friend in October of 1776, not because they know the cause, but because the mania of independence in reality has infected all the spirits, and the poison has spread imperceptibly from the works of the philosophes all the way out to the village schools. America had created a culture of liberty and equality never before seen. Paris, London, and Vienna each had their claims to financial, intellectual, or artistic freedom. But that freedom was often the freedom of the elites, of intellectuals, artists, writers, and aristocrats. In America, cultural freedom had been democratized. This probably explains many of the differences between the French Revolutionary Project and the American one. The French, accustomed to absolutism, were more inclined to replace one form of absolutism with another. In America, the people acquired a taste for liberty and demanded more of it than the English were willing to provide. In the old world, your clothes, your accent, even your last name were freighted with notions of superiority and inferiority. Sumptuary laws, codes for what garments people could wear and what products they could use, were largely repealed by the 18th century, but they endured as a kind of cultural and social uniform. Even in Britain's comparatively democratic culture, people were still expected to dress in accordance with their station. Not so in the United States. Thomas Colley Grattan, the British consul in Boston in the 1840s, disdained the peculiar culture of equality in the former colonies. Servant girls, he complained, were strongly infected with a national bad taste for being overdressed, they are, when walking the streets, scarcely to be distinguished from their employers. Ferenc Polsky, a Hungarian